Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Cameron McGregor, a brother by another mother. We survived Avdiivka together in its own day.
It was a bonding experience for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But in a male normal kind of thing, not in this woke, Hollywood. By the way, have you been paying attention to the remake of Odyssey?
Something feels off. Same news, same noise, different day.
Maybe you're just in the wrong place, mate.
Wait, what?
Maybe you've been here before.
I was what? I am a Cossack.
Wait, I remember this. I was a merchant.
Okay, this is getting weird. I was a Russian musician.
Okay, this is NOT what I expected.
Yeah, happens to everyone.
We just moved. Moscow Connect helped with everything.
Visa, paperwork, life is sorted.
Wait, it's actually that simple?
Maybe it's not about escaping.
Maybe it's about finding where you actually belong.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
I've heard rumors, but I don't want to believe them because I do like Christopher Nolan and I think he's a good filmmaker. But the more I learn about it, the more anxious I become.
So transvestite skinny, well, I'm going to call a woman because it's a woman, is playing Achilles. And it looks like something, you know, a 10-year-old Boy Scout would knock down. And Helena Troy, who's strictly written in the Chronicles as being light of fair of skin and fair of hair, is now sub-Saharan African. The Greeks are, by the way, having as much fun with this as the Egyptians about the black Cleopatra, who was Greek also.
Yeah, but you left out the key takeaway, which is Oscar buzz is coming. So the rumor is, you know, he sold out because he wants that coveted and elusive Oscar, and we'll see if he gets it. I don't know, but his fans are pissed off, that's for sure.
Can he get the Oscar if the movie is a failure at the box office?
I think that helps your case.
We only take the losers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I did see Ridley Scott's movie, or at least I tried to watch his Napoleon film. Did you see that? That was a train wreck, too.
I've seen portions of it, and I've seen clips awful on YouTube that it came out with, and I just kind of like, maybe if it's for free. And I don't know if I want to spend that much of my life on a free version.
It's awful. Yeah, it's just he reined it in. And I like Ridley Scott, too, just like Nolan. So I don't know. I mean, look, everybody, you're never going to put out a perfect product. But I think it's the sign of the times. And, what do you expect more from Hollywood? We need an overhaul of that industry, too.
But hey, at least Ripley's Napoleon wasn't like Chinese or sub-Saharan African or Aborigines from,
Don't say it too loud because they might hear you.
Damn it, we're remaking it again. Re-edit it quick.
They might hear you and they might just go ahead and do it.
Just to piss Stoss off. Oh, yeah. Okay. You didn't like it enough then. Here, have another taste. Have some more, baby.
Well, I mean, it's not as if there's a fan base, some shadow constituency out there that's been calling for any of this crap for decades, and yet they keep doing it against the interests of their own industry. And I'm going to give you a softball transition here. It's kind of like the White House now, isn't it? Dumb and dumber.
Just before we do the transition, I'm just waiting for a blue-eyed blonde Shaka Zulu.
Now that I don't think you're going to see come, because that's appropriation, but the reverse is not. So
yeah, that's right. We don't have any culture. The white nations don't have culture.
Yeah, they don't make sense, but they still have them.
Yeah, you don't have your own culture. By the way, did you see the there was a Swede made a Swedish made documentary about the original Swedes? Apparently, they were also sub-Saharan Africans.
Really? I didn't know that. I gotta revisit that history.
The things you didn't know, and then the evil white people showed up and took away their ancestral homeland in northern Sweden while they were busy hunting buffalo and mammoths, and the evil white people showed up and took over the land.
You know, the propaganda I remember when I was in the service, and I know you experienced the same, more so than I did because I wasn't in very long, but it used to be somewhat more subtle. Now it's just, you know, no holds bar. Let's just completely rewrite everything. Let's make it completely obvious. It's incredible.
You know, the first real experience with it was Equal Opportunity Commission. They came in. I was on brigade staff, and we had this one specialist clerk who screwed up and put all the officers in the system as ready for the next assignment. Luckily, the sergeant saw that, chewed the ass out, and switched everything back before the Pentagon computers had a chance to pick up and start reassigning everybody. So Equal Opportunity comes in there, and I had to go in for an interview too, because they're interviewing everybody, all the officers, about the racial and gender bias. So the specialist put in two complaints, race and gender. And I'm sitting there looking at, by the way, the whole team that came in there were black guys. Mm-hmm. Okay, whatever, from the Pentagon. And I'm looking at it, I was like, okay, what's the gender element here? They're both women. What's the racial bias? They're both white, blonde, blue-eyed women with German last names. I'm missing something here. Like, well, sir, you know, it's a complaint, so we have to investigate, and we have to take up your time and everybody else's time and spend a lot of money on just this.
Well, you forgot about white fragility, you know? That's what you're missing.
Yeah, apparently.
That's the key. But, you know, I will say before we get off of this is that I did read Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda. Mm-hmm. And that's a sort of famous tome in the conspiracy world. Edward Bernays, incidentally, was related to Sigmund Freud. But one of the things he says in there is that society requires the conscious and intelligent manipulation of mass opinion, essentially. But that presupposes intelligence. And that kind of propaganda that we're discussing, that has nothing to do with anything intelligent. It's just cockamamie,
Yep. Well, you know, it was Goebbels that said, you know, it's not just saying a lie loud enough, but you have to have a grain of truth in there, and then you build the lie around it. And it was Zelensky who said, I need 1,000 Goebbels. Yeah, 1,000 people telling a lie.
Yeah, well, I think the new iteration makes Goebbels look rather miniature in his vision, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. It also makes Orwell look rather provincial.
Oh, yeah. It does, yeah. That guy really, I mean, just opened the door but had no idea the universe of bullshit that the powers that be could come up with, that's for sure.
Oh, my God, yeah. He's got to be, you know, if they resurrected him right now, he'd be looking at reality going, holy crap! No way I would have imagined this.
You know? That's right. Brave New World for sure, that's for sure.
There was a T-shirt I saw. It was just it's a photograph. I'd love to find the T-shirt. Maybe I'll need to order one, draw the design and order one. It was great. It had a Venn diagram with three spheres. One was 1984. The other one was Brave New World. The third one was Fahrenheit. And where they intersected was USA.
Clever.
Yeah. Very, very interesting T-shirt. So, speaking of intersections, we had an intersection between the East and West. Trump came, would you call it a vacation tour, or what would you call that?
Maybe. He looks rather plump these days, doesn't he? It looks like he's been putting on some weight. Must be stress eating. I don't know.
Well, you know, his I don't think he got his diet of burgers and fries and the People's Hall in from Xi. But I'm pretty sure he probably ate the most expensive Chinese food he's ever eaten.
Probably, yeah. I mean, the guy, you know, it's interesting because During his first term, I remember lots of references to the president's health. Obviously, a lot of it was his mental health, and a lot of that was a hatchet job. But that's just gone silent this term. Yeah. Every now and again, you'll hear people like Chaz Freeman. There's some choice others that will talk about his mental sanity or decline. He'll talk about his physical health. But he does not look like he's in good shape to me, Shaz. I don't know what you think.
No, I don't think so. I mean, he's looking flabby. Not that he's exactly, you know, Mr. Universe to begin with. But he's looking flabby. He looks tired. You notice his hair's gotten a lot grayer. I guess he's not painting it as much anymore.
Could be. I don't know. Well, it's that Epstein diet. You know, once you get on that, it's all downhill.
The blood of little children?
Yeah. I'm not touching that one. Who knows?
Yeah, we laugh because otherwise you cry. We think it's funny. It's, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
The unfortunate truth of this. So what did Trump accomplish in his great visit to... You saw the video, the intro video from the White House of the Avenger-style video where they're getting off the plane and the children are waving the flags in slow motion. And Trump's doing the victory march in. Did you see that one?
I did not see that video.
I'll have to send it to you.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll give me a good chuckle. Well, look, I'll just say a couple things to frame the context of where I think we are right now. Interestingly enough, one of the first shows that we did, maybe it was the second, was right on the cusp of the beginning of the war.
Right.
I think it was right around the 28th of February, and we had a discussion about it. And I said, I think that the war is coming end of the month or early next month. And I think we're bookending that now, because I think that the tenuous, fractured, fragile, whatever you want to call it, ceasefire, I think that's nearly up. And so I think we're poised to strike Iran again in the next few days, at most the next few weeks. However, in between the show that we did in February, the beginning of the war, and obviously the beginning of the ceasefire, and this final strike, or at least what I think the Pentagon is hoping is going to be a final strike, and you and I know that that's not going to be the case, came this China summit. And I think the president authorized it because he thinks of himself as a deal maker. He still regards the United States as having tremendous leverage. I certainly don't see it that way for reasons that we can elaborate on, but nonetheless, his view was, well, I'll take my cohort of corporate parasites, people just like him, frankly. I hate to say that, by the way. I don't say that to defame these people. I just think that's what they are. And let's fly over to Beijing and have a powwow with President Xi, and perhaps we can leverage that relationship to reset events in the Middle East that the United States, under the influence of obviously the Israelis and the Jewish power structure in the United States, have royally screwed up. And I think the Chinese said two things. One is that they're standing behind Iran. And so whatever mishaps have gone on in the Strait, it's our mess. And we're going to clean it up or else. So that's number one, I suppose. And by clean up, I mean de-escalate, you know, because they're going to stay behind Iran. And I have reason to believe that even during the ceasefire and the blockade of the blockade, I think the Chinese are still getting various ships out, whether that's through the territorial waters. I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but there's no question about it, the strategic alliance between Iran and China in particular, but also the Russians, that is rigidifying. So that's one. And secondly, and you know, we talked about this the last time we had a show together, the Chinese and their moment has arrived. And so I think President Xi was a bit more self-confident. And you know how the Chinese are. They tend to be more subtle. They're not going to make some kind of grandiose statement. But he said in no uncertain terms, you will not meddle in the internal affairs of China and Taiwan or else. That's the line.
Yep.
The trouble, Shaz, with all of this is that I don't think that the gerontocrats or the technocrats inside DC, I don't think they got the message. And I think their view is that the shift in the balance of power that you and I know has already occurred, they don't perceive that either. And so they're just going to double down. And my guess is, and I watched the interview that Trump made with Bret Baier, which he said a lot of just asinine things. He still thinks that the United States ultimately...
interrupt you for a second. When does Trump not say a lot of asinine things?
Yeah. Good point. But in any case, he still thinks, and importantly, and this is, I think, the key takeaway that a lot of people are missing, it's not just Donald Trump that thinks this way.
No.
I think it's the broader landscape of Capitol Hill, of the foreign policy establishment, mm-hmm. the Defense Department at senior levels, et cetera, et cetera. They still think more or less that the United States has the cards to play, and they're going to continue as is. And that's why I think you're going to see a resumption of this conflict sooner rather than later.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you got people like Kellogg, who never went away, supposedly was fired. It's still living in the early 1990s. And I think the majority of the people around Trump, I'm not talking about, I think Keen and others kind of realize they're screwed. The U.S. military is out of missiles. It's out of munitions. It's got JDAMs, but then you got to go fly over Iran for that. But these politician advisors, especially the older ones, they haven't matured past the early 1990s.
Well, look, what have we learned since the ill-fated war began on the 28th of February? We've learned a few things. The first is that Iran was well prepared for the conflict,
yes.
that they imposed severe costs, not just on the U.S. military, but on the Gulf states, and demonstrated, I think, categorically that there's a shift in the balance of power in the region that doesn't favor the Israelis. And, of course, the structural change mainly is that they control the Straits of Hormuz, which obviously is a situation now that we're trying to restore. That is a structural change that is clear, that's unambiguous, that can't be denied. The balance of power, that can be denied to some degree, not for much longer, but it can be. But not the fact that they control the Straits of Hormuz. And so there is immense pressure being brought to bear on the president from his own party. This is not just about war hawks, but people that are saying the U.S. military has the arbitrary capacity to decide the fate of the Straits. And again, you and I know that that is not the case, because warfare has changed. Iran has a 21st century military and the United States does not. And then, of course, and this is something I just don't think people realize, there is this assertion, particularly on Wall Street and I think across the United States, that even though the United States did not start this war for U.S. national interests, and it clearly did not, that we will somehow withdraw because of U.S. national interests. The folks on Wall Street think that at the end of the day, Trump will taco, because Trump always chickens out. He's got the midterms coming. Oil prices are rising. Yields on the 10-year treasury are rising. So he will withdraw. But the problem with that is that the structural drivers of the war remain firmly in place. And that is to say, and to be very clear about this, that the Jared Kushners, the Stephen Witkoffs, the Jewish power structure in particular that made this war happen, they remain in power. And no blue wave this fall is going to change that either.
Well, most of the blue wave is bought just as well.
Yes. That's right.
That's
right. So I just think, you know, because I saw an interview with Trita Parsi, and he was doing a kind of forensic analysis of Trump's tweets. A, that's a bad idea. don't recommend it for your health. But B, this is not about Trump strategically. It is about Trump tactically. There's no question about that. He does have agency to some degree, but he's playing in a box.
Yeah.
And that box means further escalation of this conflict until violence consolidates the shift in the balance of power. And obviously the collateral damage for that is going to be harrowing for the world. So I think we're about to go from a crisis of sorts, economically, an energy crisis, into an emergency. And it's going to be brought about by a president who's running out of options, who doesn't know what else to do. And let's call it what it is. I think there have been three moments in the president's life, his political life anyway, that were key inflection points. The first was when that Billy Bush tape was released. I want to say in 2016, when he was running against Hillary Clinton, in which he made some poorly phrased statements about the opposite gender.
Yep.
And he was immediately pressured to resign. And how did he respond? Well, the president, Steve Bannon, they rolled out all of these victims or alleged victims of Bill Clinton, and they fired exactly back. And it happened to work. So he survived that inflection point. He became president. The next was in 2020, during the January of 6 and the supposedly stolen election. And the president came out aggressively, staged a rally, quibbled with the results. We know the rest of the story. It was plausible that the election was, or possible, you know, that you could buy that it was stolen. So he survived that as well. And now he's got the next inflection point, which will determine his fate. And that is whether or not he withdraws or escalates. And as is customary for the president, it's his pattern of behavior. What's he going to do, Stas?
Double down.
He's going to double down and attack.
Yep. But here's the problem. With what? I mean, you know as well as I do, if they send, it's summertime. It is 45 to 50 degrees Celsius. That's up to 100, 50 degrees Celsius. That's 82. That's 115 degrees Fahrenheit. 100% humidity on those islands. They're islands. But, you know, you go in about 2 kilometers off the coast and you're starting to hit the opposite. You know, the humidity just drops like a rock. Depending on where you're at, you're in a rock desert or you're in a sand desert. Where are you going to go? With what troops? There's a million men on the other side dug in the mountains defending their homeland. And the U.S. has, what, 10,000 airborne and air assault and another 6,000-7,000 Marines?
So according to the New York Times, and I'm sure you saw the report as well as I did, I read the Substack from Simplicius, I think that's what it's called. And essentially what was reported is that the damage that we inflicted in the first phase of the war was less on Iran than we thought, that they have reconstituted 90 to 95% of all of their missile sites, their launchers, et cetera, not just in the Strait, but across Iran. And conversely, that the United States has actually taken more losses. That seems transparent and clear to you and me. But as I said a moment ago, that doesn't mean that the president believes that. It doesn't mean that the brass at senior levels is communicating that. And furthermore, remember that what was said and widely reported was that the initial phase of the attack was somewhat haphazard, that it wasn't well calculated, that we weren't fully in place and ready. And so my answer to your question is, you're right, but I'm not sure that that is established at those higher levels of the Citadel power. And secondly, I think this time they're going to bring in their mind, the heavy guns, and they're going to let loose thinking that, well, this will be enough to seal the fate of the Iranians. And remember, the narrative operating in the background has been that Iran has fragmented or fractured in terms of its leadership and is sort of teetering on the edge because the blockade has choked them off. I don't believe that. I think that's an inaccurate assessment. I'm sure you agree with me.
Absolutely.
But that is what a lot of people in Washington think. And remember, the hubris, and this is sort of a legacy of American power. This is Pax Americana circa 1990. Well, if the United States military really wants to lay the hammer down, they can do it and we'll get control back of the straits. So the answer to your question is it's delusion. It's delusion.
Control of straits they never had. And that's another thing, you know. You know, freedom of navigation, all that. But the straits are not neutral waters.
Yeah, that's right.
They're either Iranian or they're Omani.
It's not just that. It's, you know, it's true, right? And I remember sailing through the straits, which was precarious in 2008 when I was there. And even then, you know, you're talking about small boat attacks and things like that. Obviously, warfare has morphed well beyond that. But it was sort of tenuous at best even then. But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. empire is a facade. It is a sort of thinly veiled glass house. And what Iran has done is exposed it. And we should withdraw. We should mm-hmm. retrench. We should come back to our hemisphere. We don't need the petrodollar. I mean, let's call it what it is. We've screwed up the Middle East as it is. We have destabilized that region for decades. We need to come home. But as I said, the neocons, you know, the globalists, whatever you want to call these people, the Zionists, they orchestrate more power over the U.S. government today than they ever have.
Yep.
At a time when the U.S. military and its ability to flex is weaker than it's been in probably 50 years, maybe 100 years. It depends on how you look at it. But the key that you have to remember about all of this is you got to go back to 2003, an interview that was done by Thomas Friedman with Haaretz magazine. And he was asked about the Iraq war. And he said, and I quote, "I could give you the names of 25 people, all of whom are at this moment within a five-block radius of this office," I think it was in New York, "who, if you had exiled them to a desert island a year and a half ago, the Iraq war would not have happened." Well, it's not 25 people today. It's the whole government, more or less. And anybody that disagreed, they're out. And as it happens, I don't know if you saw this, but there is a publication called Responsible Statecraft. And there was an article that was released by Kelly Vlahos about the Israeli influence on U.S. military leaders.
Send that to me.
Elite high levels.
I know. I haven't seen it.
I'll send it to you. Well, according to Kelly Vlahos, and I have reason to believe that this is true, the last two Central Command commanders, the CENTCOM commanders, were essentially bought and paid for Israeli agents. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
You know, again, I don't want to overstate it. They're U.S. generals. But essentially, they were keenly aware and concerned with Israeli national security first and American national security second. Those are two CENTCOM commanders, the last two, okay, McKenzie and Kirilla in particular. And now Kirilla, if I understand it correctly, he is working at a company called Lazard. And Lazard is an asset management company. You know, it's part of the financial system, all of this courtesy of Miriam Adelson and the American Israeli Council, which is another AIPAC-like organization. So again, the structural drivers of the conflict, they have consolidated, they're not going anywhere. And unfortunately, there's no evidence that the political system can correct this. And that means a resumption of the conflict.
Okay, so quick question. El Jilani, American asset or Israeli asset? Or does it even matter?
Yeah, who knows?
Since he was playing basketball with CENTCOM command anyways. He's the man of the hour in Syria when he's not busy butchering children.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's just the situation, as you say, right? You don't know whether to laugh or to cry because there just aren't any safeguards. Jim Jatras, who I know you have on your show from time to time, we did a show together recently about the United States, and it was primarily focused on American national identity. But his bailiwick, as you know, was working at the State Department, focused on foreign affairs and so forth. And let's call it what it is. The American foreign policy establishment, you know, that represents America's national interests has been vacated or anemic for a long, long time. And now we're reaping the whirlwinds. And as a result, we're fighting a war that we have no interest in fighting, that we cannot win. And it's going to destroy the petrodollar. It's going to destroy the GCC. I mean, I will be surprised because I believe the Iranians. I think they will fulfill their promise, which is that if we strike them, they're going to obliterate what's left of the global energy complex underneath the umbrella of the GCC and the House of Saud, you know, Saudi Aramco. They're going to devastate these things completely. And that will be the end of the U.S. Middle Eastern empire and its surrogates. It'll be over. And obviously, the collateral damage there, too, will probably be the state of Israel. I don't exactly know how they're going to come out of this. But, of course, that raises another concern, which is the nuclear option. And I don't know how that's going to factor in, but a lot of people think it might.
You know, what we're seeing is, we're hearing in the street now, is that Fifth Fleet Forward Command is now relocating out of the Persian Gulf to Israel. Because, by the way, there's nothing left in the Persian Gulf for them to locate to. Right. It's been demolished. I'm not going to say decimated. God, I hate when people don't know how to use the word decimated. Trump has triple decimated the Iranians. Yes, he has. And 70% of their equipment is still there. You know, he decimated. Like, oh, it's just... But there, yeah, I was watching videos, and it was an American made video. They're showing the base, and there's almost not a single building that isn't either partially destroyed or fully leveled. There's just nothing there to go back to. So now they're going to locate in Israel, which, by the way, then begs to differ. Israel that's committing genocide on three fronts. By the way, the Israelis have now demanded that Tyre, a city of 4,000 or 5,000 years of age, needs to be evacuated because they're going to demolish Tyre, just like they've demolished everything else. I mean, villages have been there for 3,000 years are now down to their foundations. And the U.S. military is going to be there. So would that not paint the U.S. military with the same brush, a genocidal brush that the Israelis are doing?
Well, look, we've had for years, I don't know if I would say it's plausible deniability, but there was some daylight between Israel and the United States. That's gone. Yep. It's gone. And as you say, that's our last sort of foothold in the Middle East. But, you know, that raises several questions. If this resumption of the conflict happens, if Trump does what he's done, you know, the last 10, 15 years of his political life, and he doubles down and he attacks and Iran blows up a lot of this infrastructure and they have the capacity to do so, that means that these legacy Arab elites and, you know, in particular, I would talk about folks like MBS, but you can talk about any of these royal families, they're not going to hold on. And one of the things I don't think people understand in the United States, I know you know this very well, is that there's a big difference, just as there is in the United States and Western Europe, between the governments, between the elite families, you know, the sheikhs that are running things, and the Arab street. And the Arab street wants war. They want recompense for what the Israelis have done throughout the entire course of the Nakba, you know, the catastrophe since the state of Israel was created. So I think it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, for a lot of these royal families and elites, whether you're talking about Morsi in Egypt, you're talking about the Jordanians, they're going to crumble. And then you're going to see whatever's left of support for Israel and the United States, it'll obliterate. I think that's where we're headed, and then we'll have to liquidate and get out. Unfortunately, we should have done this proactively, but just like our dear cousins, the Brits, we're only going to do it when we go bankrupt and we blow up the world, unfortunately.
Well, let's hope the world's not blowing up, but the bankruptcy's coming. What are you seeing on the American street right now? I mean, it's the oil, all these people, you know, Trump is trying to sell, we're selling the oil, which it's actually the strategic reserve. We're selling the oil. They're all lining up to buy our oil. We're stinking rich. Everything's great. Oh, and inflation is just going to be gone in the next week or so, or in a week. We're just going to tell you which week.
Right. Now, let's talk going up because the situation is very interesting right now in the U.S. The energy crisis is beginning to affect the Western Europeans. Mm-hmm. But even there, the effect is sort of a mild sunburn. It's not so anything crucial yet, but this is what's compelling about this situation. Over the last 2 months, or I guess 80 days now, if you can believe it, 80 days. This was supposed to be over in 72 hours, if you recall.
Oh, yeah.
Over the last 80 days, we have essentially seen what's left of the pre-war global energy complex flex, adjust to cushion the blow. So that means a few things. The first is that the pre-war oil inventories around the world in the strategic reserves was at record highs. Right. I mean, there was a supply glut. You probably remember this. That has been worked down. So that's number one. Number two is that you had this lag effect because it takes a lot of time. You know, we're talking 20, 30 days to get ships, these very large crude carriers from the Gulf to their destination. So that meant that even though the war started in 28 February, you have ships that are still coming in. And I think that is finally petered out. So I think the last arrival was in California like 2 weeks ago, something like that. But anyway, again, there was a lag effect. The third is, and you may have heard more about this than I have too, is that there are these so-called soft barrels. It's this shadow inventory that's sort of barrels on hand here and there. And I've heard numbers of like a billion barrels, okay, that have been brought to market under the radar, if you will. And all of these things, they haven't prevented prices from going up, but they have cushioned the blow substantially. And Wall Street at the same time, and this, you know, I talked about last time I was on, they're, the market's at all-time highs, but oil prices in particular are priced to fall and go right back to, you know, $60 a barrel. And I think the worst case scenario is that the Strait won't open again until like late June or July, right? The base case from Wall Street is that it's going to get open anytime soon. Insane.
Which no is basis in reality.
It has none, but there is a denial, there's a delusion that's going on. And the point is that we're now entering a scenario in which this adjustment is not going to be gradual because it's been delayed. So you're going to just hit a wall. And I think we're going to hit that wall sometime this summer, at the latest September.
Well, you know, if you look at the charts, the British, the Germans, and the French run out of reserves by early to mid-June. That's just down the road. That's two to 4 weeks, and they have no reserves left. I mean, I guess they'll still be buying American reserves, whatever's left of those reserves. Because they never got COVID.
But see, that's the other issue, Stas, and you know where I'm going with this, is that if prices do spike in the United States, and they will because it's a global market, and we don't have the robust network that people think because we're still importing. I know you know all those details, but the point is that what do you think the U.S. government's going to do? They're going to cushion the blow further by cutting exports. And those exports, where are they going to be cut? In Europe. So they're counting on supply that it's almost certainly going to come offline, right? So you add these sorts of things in, and then, of course, operating in the background to make matters worse, interest rates, particularly in the treasury market in the United States, but across Western Europe and specifically the United Kingdom, they're at danger levels now. And I think, and what I've heard from Duran, I think they're a mutual friend of ours,
yes,
and I think their analysis is very good. Stammer is going to be gone soon. Either he will voluntarily resign, or there'll be some kind of a coup, and that's going to gyrate the market up even more. And of course, Europe is structurally in a recession as it is. So look, we are in dangerous, dangerous waters, but the point is, it's not going to hit in a delayed fashion. It's going to hit all at once. And then I think you're going to see governments in an emergency. And as far as I can tell, Stas, nobody in Western Europe is worried about any of this. They haven't done anything to prepare.
Most of the people are clueless. You know, talk to people. You know, of course, some of the people, a lot of people I talk to, they have a concept of what's going on because they're informed. But they'll all tell you, the vast majority of the population, if you talk to them, they don't have a clue. They've been lulled to sleep that it's all okay. We've got you covered. We're the masters of the universe. Not the incompetent moron, inbred morons that actually rule you.
Look, it is a truly, it is a true permutation in the world that's happening right now. You know, again, just to go back to the Straits and then build on that for a moment, it's not just that Iran has control of the Straits, it's also that they're scaffolding an alternative payment system that's operating completely outside of the dollar. Now, the Russians have been doing this for years, but now you're talking about maybe the most important choke point in the global energy system that essentially renders the dollar and the financial system in the West irrelevant, superfluous. And there's nothing we can do about that. By the way, that's probably yet another reason why we will attack, because the president is probably being pressured by Wall Street to undermine that or to at least challenge it. Anyway, at the same time that that is happening, in recent weeks, and this you may not be privy to, Moody's, so the credit ratings agency, downgraded some of your major private credit institutions, these are the so-called shadow banks, to junk status or near junk status. We're talking about firms like KKR. By the way, that's where Dave Petraeus, another starlight of U.S. military brass, that's where he
and CIA.
That's where he works. And CIA, right? But anyway, KKR is not some chop shop, okay? This is a major asset allocator in the U.S. economy. It's in trouble. Apollo, BlackRock and all these firms have had to halt redemptions because they're having liquidity crises. Now, again, how bad that is, I don't know, but it's bad. And then I heard a couple of weeks ago that a major real estate investment trust, so you're talking about pensions, hedge funds that bought up all this commercial real estate through this fund, well, they had to halt redemptions. And according to the billionaire that owns it, a guy named Barry Sternlicht, who's a big real estate tycoon in the United States, he's another billionaire, he said essentially they won't permit redemptions until they're liquid again. Whoops. I mean, this is a big deal. This is a big, big deal. This is sort of like pre-2008. And of course, at the center of all of it, you got this energy crisis and a war. So I frankly think we're going to see fireworks this summer that are going to shock people. I mean, shock them.
Cameron, we're fortunately got a time constraint on this show this time. Next time we won't. But it was a schedule issues. So I want to thank you for coming on. I know we things got pushed back. We're supposed to do it a little earlier and have more time, but it happens. And on that note, I guess if we talk in another week or two, we'll be able to see what happens. The over-under of
if
Trump
we make
attacking.
It that far. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, I'm hoping to make it at least to the end of summer. I got vacation plan, damn it. they better not screw up my vacation plans. I'm getting very angry.
You know, it's funny. I'll just leave you with this, is that I periodically have these kinds of conversations with folks that are not embedded in this stuff every day the way you and I are. And so I'll go through this long spiel, talk about Iran, I'll talk about escalation, I'll talk about China, you know, energy, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll sort of sit there with a puzzled look and they'll say, should I cancel my summer trip to Europe? maybe you should think about that.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Everybody, thank you. I apologize for the short session today, but we will make up for it next time. Cameron, thank you very much. And we'll see you on the next one, and review your vacation schedule.
always appreciate it, Stas, and dobre večer to your audience.
Thank you.